Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Fantasy. I am your host, A.E. Lanier. Today, I will be speaking with T. Kingfisher about her new novel, Thornhedge, a retelling of Sleeping Beauty that follows Toadling, the person in charge of keeping the fair maiden asleep inside her tower, and the thorns that surround that tower strong. T. Kingfisher the fantasy and horror writer, known for books such as Nettle and Bone, What Moves the Dead, and House with Good Bones. She's also Ursula Vernon, the award-winning artist and children's book writer. She is joining us now. Hi, Ursula. It's great to have you.
Hi, A. It's fabulous to be here. And then it occurs to me suddenly, I don't know if I say hi, A, or hi, A-E.
Either is fine.
Okay.
So to start off, could you tell us a little bit about your interest in retellings generally and what stood out to you about Sleeping Beauty in particular?
I think retellings, I like to do retellings and pastiches and things because A, I'm very bad with plots. Plots are the hard part. And so if you do a retelling, you particularly like a fairy tale retelling, you have a plot already laid out. You just get to find new ways to break it. So I enjoy that. I am also, if we're going to be completely honest, motivated by a combination of a desire out of spite and a desire to fix things. So I will frequently read something and be like, no one acts like that. This is what would have happened. Or, you know, things like that. For example, my novella, What Moves the Dead, came about entirely because I read Fall of the House of Usher and was like, the narrator is the most useless friend in the history of the world. And so I am going to fix that. And yes, there is certain arrogance deciding you're going to fix one of the most famous and, you know, great stories in the English horror canon. But here we are. So in the case of Sleeping Beauty, I never liked Sleeping Beauty. And like, I never liked the princess because she doesn't do anything. She like her entire goal is just to fall asleep or her purpose is to fall asleep. She is if you could replace the character with a sexy lamp, then you should just do so. She is a sexy lamp. And so I wanted to tell the story in a way that made it interesting. So I did, but as a children's book, I actually wrote a story called Harriet the Invincible, which is a children's book. It's the first of the Hamster Princess series where Harriet the Hamster should have been Sleeping Beauty and uses the fact that she's going to fall asleep at the age of 12 as she's like, okay, if the magic means I have to fall asleep at the age of 12, that means I have to be alive at the age of 12, that means I'm invincible, that means I'll think of cliff diving. And it was a very fun story. She's this very tough, vibrant, adventurous, you know, warrior. And I really enjoyed writing it, but at the same time, while I was doing it, there was this sense that I could have also gone a completely different way. I could have, it was like I was standing on a road, looking down the road, but if I turned around and looked behind me, there was the diametrically opposite way that I could go. And Thornhedge is that diametrically opposite way. It's the character is very, very different. Toadling, the main character, is very different from Harriet. It's a book for adults, and but it was still there as the way I could have gone with that story. So I wanted to go that direction with it.
What was it about Toadling as a protagonist that sort of stood out to you or made you want to explore her?
I started writing, I was like a page in, and I loved her. Because and it's dangerous to fall in love with your own characters because then you don't either treat them as badly as the story requires or you assume the reader loves them automatically and you not put in any of the work to make them lovable. But she was just very anxious and very worried and trying to do the right thing and overwhelmed. And these are all emotions that I feel on a regular basis. And I was like, oh yeah, I know exactly how you feel. You are. This is a way too big a job for you, but you have to do it, and you don't want to let everyone down, and you're constantly worrying if you're doing the right thing. I'm like, oh yeah, yep. I know all of these emotions. And she was a were-toad. And honestly, if I could be a were-toad, my life would be very different.
It absolutely would be. And she is super adorable. I also love her. She's great.
Oh, good.
Could you talk a little bit? So she can turn into a toad, which is amazing. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what she can and can't do, or how she is as a like magical being?
Sure. How much spoilering should I do here?
Yeah. So I guess more like broad strokes.
Yeah. She's a fairy, sort of, a fairy kind of by accident, and certainly not by design. She is not, you know, some great and powerful Oberon or Titania-like figure. She can do some stuff, and water likes her. And if water is your friend, you can do a lot of things if you're clever. And she can turn into a toad. And she's basically between water likes me and I can do some very small magics and I can turn into a toad, she manages to make those things work for her very hard. Which, you know, if you want to grow a giant hedge of thorns, then it's useful to be able to water them and things like that. So and a lot of it is she has the sort of magic that is asking things for help and favors, not standing and demanding and do this or ordering it. She tries to make friends and request help rather than command it.
I feel like that magic feeds so well into the natural world. Definitely, I've read a lot of Sleeping Beauty retellings at this point, and I don't think the natural world and the Briars in particular have ever felt quite as alive as they do in this one. The thorns feel like more like a character than an obstacle a lot of the time, in a way that is like very gentle and wholesome. And
which is odd because the hedge of thorns is like one of the very defining Sleeping Beauty things. It's up there with the spindle, but lots of people, I think, just don't see plants or they think of the thorns as an inorganic quality like the spinning wheel. And so they're just two set pieces as opposed to, you know, a huge living thing that is there.
Well, and the whole natural world really is very much a piece of this work. And you're obviously like a very avid gardener. That sense of the world is apparent in a lot of your work, is very apparent in Toadling's point of view as well. And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about like plants and like, I don't know, reclaiming the Briar's right to exist in this story.
If it's just talking about plants, I'm like, how long do you want this podcast to be? I can start and never stop. But honestly, the problem I usually have is that because I find nature endlessly fascinating, I frequently will like try to rein myself in books, because I'll be like, okay, your every single protagonist cannot be a gardener. People are going to get sick of it. And so I often find myself, you know, trying to find, and so many people don't notice the natural world unless they are, you know, involved in it deeply, that I am often trying to come up with professions or whatnot where they wouldn't pay attention, because it is, I will just write, you know, okay, the trees are, you know, okay, well, this is around here, you know, it's tulip, poplar, and sweet gum, and hickory, and oak, and all of that, as opposed to it was trees. And then I have to stop and think, okay, why would the viewpoint character even know any of that? So I have invented botanist relatives. The horror novel I handed in a month or two ago, the heroine is a scientific illustrator. It can be hard, honestly, to make the organic feel organic in the story, because I think so much writing is so very divorced from it these days. We're so used to that it's like, you know, you don't expect regular people to necessarily know what any tree they look at is. Which is, Lord knows, a big shift away from 100 years ago, or, you know, certainly 200 years ago. We have, in fact, lost vast numbers of words to describe specific things in nature. And I believe it's Robert McFarlane does, the author, does some amazing books that that have just been collections of lost words that are fallen out of favor in Britain. And so, you know, Scottish words and Cornish words and whatnot for things like the little opening at the base of a wall where rabbits go back and forth. And there was a specific word for that. And like it had a name, but because it's just not used very much, it falls out of favor. So I think Landmarks, I think, is the book. It is totally worth checking out because you just go through and it's just like, he'll have whole lists of words that, you know, and what they describe, and some of them are amazing, and you know exactly what it is, what, you know, but words for the different types of tussocks in a swamp that you step on, the ones that, you know, will fall away under your feet, the ones you can step on, and the fog that lies around it, and it's amazing. And we've become kind of divorced from that now, unfortunately. And it's not a conscious effort on my part to bring it back or anything. It's something I feel passionately about. And I also spend a lot of time in the garden looking at bugs. So it just comes up. I'm like, of course you know, want to write a book about bugs. Bugs are cool.
Well, I think that's something that's so interesting about writing, like, either actually in the past or in spaces like fairy tales where they're very like past adjacent, because you're right, people are so disconnected from the natural world in a way that is deeply unusual if you look at the experience of humans on the planet, and I think this book does a really great job of making that feel real and alive, but also in some ways accessible, because totaling it basically like a swamp fairy. And so then you're like, of course she's into the swamp, she's a swamp fairy. And then you can like learn to think about the world in that way through her.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, write textbooks on, you know, field guide to fairy tale swamp plants, although that would actually be a fabulous story, but anyway, on a yeah, I always did wonder what species the brambles around Sleeping Beauty's tower were, and I did not actually address in this one other than bramble, which is honestly in Europe a sort of generic, you know, that thing. Here it would probably be Himalayan blackberry.
Do you have an answer in the story that you just left out, or did you like set that as a boundary for yourself that you weren't going to go in that deep?
I think I actually got so distracted by other things I forgot to mention it. If I had sat down and like worked out, but no, it's just it's a bramble thicket patch thorn thing, which like kind of like hedgerows, they're not one species, they're just a whole bunch of things that grow up very densely and thickly, and briar patches, you know, can be like that. There's three or four species in there all sort of knotted around each other as it like that environment. So it's probably a mix of things. Now that's going to bug me and I'm going to have to go think about it.
I'm so sorry, but also please get back to us, because now I'm also very curious. So there's obviously like fairies in this fairy tale retelling. And I was wondering how you went about thinking about the ways in which you were going to include like the fae or not. And particularly your choice to focus mostly on green teeth.
I hadn't seen it done before. And the green teeth are Jenny Greenteeth is the name of the sort of original, probably English monster. And, you know, they're child-stealing monsters that live in water and swamps. And they're your classic kind of, you tell kids that it will eat you so they stay away from the water kind of thing, monster. And I believe one shows up in the Pratchett book, We Free Men, but that was the only reference I had ever seen to green teeth. And I had read about them a million years ago when I was a little kid and had a book that I think changed the course of my life, which was called the Encyclopedia of Fantasy Monsters, and of course, Encyclopedia of Legendary Creatures, that's it. And the illustrations were by, and it was, you know, one of those sort of books that you read as a kid that has like the Cliff Notes version of a whole bunch of different things. But the illustrations were by Victor Ambras, who is an amazing illustrator. And they were very vivid, and it was much better written than a lot of them. And it had all of these monsters that like were kind of obscure, and it didn't shy away from the sort of horrific elements of a lot of it. Like there was one, the Ahuizotl, which was, I'm probably mispronouncing that, which was a Aztec monster that would drown people, and then the bodies would be washed up on shore, missing their teeth, toenails, fingernails and toenails and eyeballs. And I like spent hours trying to figure out what it was doing with the teeth and the fingernails and the toenails. I assumed it ate the eyes. I finally decided, I think, that it was that it had an extra hand on its tail. And I was like, what if it doesn't have fingernails and it's stealing the fingernails to use them on its tail? And yeah, that's the kind of kid I was. But it had green teeth in it. And so I was one of the monsters that was sort of floating around in my brain. And I was like, I don't think anybody's done that. I don't think anybody, certainly no one has done anything that is sympathetic to the green teeth that is like what their life was like. And what do you eat when you can't get small child who got too close to the river and things like that. I think it's just such a minor, you know, weird, nasty thing as opposed to, you know, the other parts of Fae, which are like, you know, the great and terrible and horrifying and powerful. They're just kind of a thing where it's over in the corner of the swamp eating children.
They're very sweet and wholesome in this book for like creatures that eat children.
I often wrote very wholesome things. I don't know why it ends up that way. Like, this book is so wholesome and sweet. And I think Thornhedge is very sweet. I kept saying this is a very sweet book, and then I would stop and be like, okay, there are some corpses and child eating monsters, but it's sweet.
I mean, there's definitely like a lot of death, but there's also, I think, this mutual appreciation throughout like most of the characters in the book, that for all the like child eating monsters and corpses and various things, like creates like a warm necromantic vibe.
It's just how I wind up writing, I think.
And speaking of people that are like often not actually gentle, and in this really are, could you tell us a little about Haleem, who after Toadling is probably like the biggest character in this book?
Yeah. Well, if you're going to have Sleeping Beauty, sooner or later the knight is going to show up to try to rescue her. And in this case, the knight is Haleem, who is, he is a knight. He is Muslim. He's a very nice person. He's actually a very gentle soul. But if you're a knight in the Middle Ages, you know, bad things happen. And he's not, you know, great at being a knight. He's not, I don't think he's really as bad at it as he thinks he is. But honestly, if you don't have a lot of money, a lot of knights were extremely poor and just went around to tournaments, you know, trying to win money and jousts and things. And if you lost at a joust, I mean, historically, this is true. If you lost at a joust, like, you would often have to put your armor up as, like, the forfeit. And so you were like, then you'd have to get the money to ransom back your armor kind of thing. It was not really easy. And since, as I think he says, people in this particular iteration of fake medieval Europe discovered that having orders of knights was an easy way to get your penniless younger sons out of the house. He is sort of, you know, wanders around a lot, and he likes stories, and he finds a book about interesting, you know, that has an interesting story in it about a castle surrounded by thorns, and he's like, yeah, I'll go check that out. I'm not doing anything else. And then finds himself meets Toadling and finds himself embroiled in the story. And he is also very sweet. He is trying very hard to do the right thing as a knight. But also, I mean, he doesn't want to be rude. You find a fairy and you shouldn't be rude, but also she seems very sweet. And he's like, is she trapped here under a curse? Is she under a curse? Is there a curse? I don't know what's going on. And I liked him too a lot because he goes through a fairly logical problem solving kind of, and usually that's exactly what I'd do in a situation like that. Okay, is this a curse? Well, let's see if we can break the curse somehow. You know, let's get out the salt and let's get someone to bless this. And okay, I guess I can get holy water. It's not my religion. And okay, I found a rabbi, but he wants to come along and talk to the fairy, and she seems very shy, so maybe put that on hold. So he's very likable.
He is a sweet cinnamon roll that is doing his best, and I love him. This book, I think, does a really interesting job of feeling, right, very set in the Middle Ages and set in a time, in the way that stories often are, right? Like, Helene talks about his family originally coming from Anatolia. You have this sense of Black Death and plague going on, but there still very much is this fairy tale sense as well, particularly because Toadling is our point of view, and Toadling is not super in touch with what humans are doing. And so I think that was just a really interesting blending of being both like grounded in this fictional history and still very fairy tale. I was just wondering how intentional that was, what you thought about sort of the temporal setting moving into the story.
I actually sat down and worked out the history more or less of the era. It diverges basically from our reality as an alternate history, I suppose, the point right before the First Crusade. And instead of a First Crusade, you get the final plague of Justinian, which the plagues of Justinian were huge major plagues prior to the Black Death. But there was never a final plague of Justinian. In this case, the Crusade got cut off by having a Black Death-style massive plague that swept over Europe and took out like 50% of the population. And so from there, and then I, you know, basically worked out the history. And this is a history that I've kind of had kicking around in my head for a while. Like, a couple of my alternate fairy tales are set there. It just doesn't come up as much because there's, you know, in real life, most of us don't sit around and speak exposition for the benefit of the reader about, you know, well, here we are 600 years after the Black Death swept Europe kind of thing. And maybe we should start, I don't know, maybe it would help people catch up on the timeline. But so this is a setting that a couple of other of my books have kind of been in, but it hasn't really come to the forefront as much. And in this one, because Toadling basically for a couple of centuries is sitting and watching things go by, I was like, okay, we gotta figure this out here. And okay, so we gotta put the plague here and this here and migration in here. And these are the factors. And then the Danes would have invaded Europe instead of England. And I worked, honestly, I think maybe it was Therese Nielsen Hayden who said once that all alternate history comes down to how much you hate the Holy Roman Empire. Yeah, that was basically all of this. I was like, okay, so we just get rid of the Holy Roman Empire. We do this, let's put this here. So it's much more worked out than it, I think, but hopefully then it comes out across the book. Like, I don't do a big info dump about history because Toadling doesn't care. And at one point, I think Helene tries to explain it and he's just like, oh, I'm really bad with dates. I'm sorry. I don't remember when this happened. So, which is like me trying to explain the Black Death to somebody.
Well, I think time plays such an interesting role in the novel generally, because you have, first off, like, moving between fairy and the human realm, so things are wonky there, and then time both passing very quickly and not. Toadling spends a lot of time as a toad, and toads have a different relationship to time. So that was just something that I thought was a really interesting theme throughout. And did you know, sort of coming in, how long you thought the story was going to take?
No, I never know anything. Half the time, I didn't plot anything. I literally just was like, huh, and sat down and started typing the first paragraph. And usually it stayed the first paragraph, like the intro, like I didn't, you know, go back and be like, okay, we actually have to start this, you know, 50 pages later or whatnot. I was just like started somewhere and it wound up being where it started. I don't know what I'm doing. I discover it as I go along. There's the pantser versus plotter, but some people prefer discovery writer, which is you discover what's happening as you write it, which certainly is true of how I wind up writing a lot of things. I did not know. I knew there was a knight. I didn't know what Halim was like until basically it was time for him to say his first couple sentences. And then I found out along the way. So by now I have done this and written sufficiently many books that I have a lot of faith in the process that by the time I get there, my brain will grab the thing that either should go there or a thing that goes there perfectly fine. I mean, there are 100 different ways any given story could go, and most of them would be equally good. But I just go with whatever my brain grabbed to shove in the character-shaped hole there. And I was like, oh, you seem nice.
Yeah, you are. One of the things that I think a lot about with Halim in particular is sort of this idea of like trust and appearances. One of the things that a lot of fairy tale retellings end up deconstruct it is this idea of being like good and healthy and able-bodied or being beautiful as examples of goodness, which is obviously deeply troubling and something that a lot of retellings play with. And Halim feels very authentically like sort of pushing against that to begin with. And the story does too. And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about sort of like appearances and trust and how those came into the story.
Well, it's a very, very... I was about to say 19th century Christian thing, but it's been going on for way longer than the 19th century. That, you know, the good and just must be beautiful. And if you are ugly, you know, the ugly old witch is bad. And if something bad happens to you, if you are ugly or if you are sick, it is because you are bad and God did that to you. It's a very, very... Middle Ages kind of view of morality that if you are healthy, it is because you deserve to be, and if you are sick, then it must be because you deserve to be kind of thing. We have not gotten as far from that, and as God knows I would like, there is still a great deal of it must be your fault that you are disabled or sick or whatever in underlying so much of our modern the way we treat disability and illness and fatness and every axis of everything. But toads are awesome, but very few, they are considered one of the ugly animals by people who are not herpetologists and enthusiasts. And so right out of the gate, Toadling was never going to be beautiful. I mean, she's either a toad or she's a woman who looks kind of like a toad. That's just how it is. And the fact that Halim does not know for 90% of the novella that whether or not she's the good guy, he is flying blind and talking to someone who certainly looks like she is, you know, the wicked swamp fairy who is keeping a prisoner in a tower, and it comes down to whether or not he decides to trust her. And realistically, many knights in the Middle Ages probably would have tried to chop Toadling's head off, and then it would be a much different, sadder story. But Halim's cool.
Yeah. Even if there's not consistent trust, there's respect for the like beings around, which
yes,
is sweet.
Yeah. And trust is such a complicated thing. Like, I think some character in another book I wrote somewhere said something like, trust is a combination of your faith in someone's goodwill and your understanding of their abilities. Like, I can trust that, you know, the dog means me no harm, but I can't trust her to stay alone with a ribeye steak on the table. That's not because I don't trust her. That's because I know what her capacity is, and it is not to leave a ribeye steak on the table, even though she is an extremely trustworthy dog, as these things go, and that she's not ever going to bite anyone or anything. You know, it's, you trust people in different ways, and you trust that you have to know what people are capable of and not ask them to do things that are beyond their capacity. Yeah, something like that. It's yeah. complicated.
Well, I think that ambiguity is so interesting, right? Because no one really knows what anyone else's perspective or capacity or goals are.
Oh, yeah. But and it's entirely possible, as I think Halim says at one point, you know, this entire thing could be you under a spell trying to gain my trust. And he doesn't say that I'm sure he thought it, which was, you know, maybe this entire thing is just a very clever curse. Maybe you're a victim of the curse too. And I shouldn't be, you know, like trying to break it in the usual fashion, because that will free you. Maybe you're not able to tell me the truth. So now I'm having to figure out whether I think you're under the curse and saying that because of the curse, or whether it's actual reality. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really fun, sweet novel with a lot of swamps in the best way.
Swamps are awesome. I live in a swamp now. I mean, not like actually in a swamp. The house is not sinking, as we thought it might be a little, but that's neither here nor there. But this is a very swampy area. It's very humid. And I like deserts, frankly, that's where I grew up, but I have learned to appreciate swamp life since moving to North Carolina. They have a lot of really cool carnivorous plants here.
And I think really anyone looking to develop an appreciation for swamp life should definitely pick up this novel. It's, again, such a sweet, gentle, murderous, damp retelling, and it's so much fun. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us about it. I really enjoyed this conversation.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you. I have been speaking with T. Kingfisher about her novel Thorn Hedge, out on August 15th. I have been your host, A.E. Lanier. Thank you so much for listening. And please consider feeding the algorithms by subscribing, leaving a review, shouting about Thorn Hedge to the moon in the middle of the night, all of those things. I will speak to you soon. And for now, happy reading.